more lying in the blood. It was Zero. And Zero was everywhere. Zero was inside him, ripping and tearing, emptying him out like the rabbits, and he opened his mouth to scream, but no sound came. Gray, 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 gray. In his office on L2, Richards was sitting at his terminal, his mind deep inside a game of free cell. Hand number 36,592, he had to admit, was squarely kicking his ass. He'd played it a dozen times already, coming close but never quite figuring out how to build his columns, how to clear out all the aces when he needed to free up the red eights. In that sense, it reminded him a little of game 14,712, which was all about the red eights, too. It had taken him most of a day to crack that one. But every game was winnable. That was the beauty of free cell. The cards were dealt, and if you looked at them right, if you made the right moves, one after the other, sooner or later the game was yours. One victorious click of the mouse and all the cards sailed up the columns. Richards never got tired of it, which was good, because he still had 91,048 games to go, counting this one. There was a 12-year-old kid in Washington State who claimed to have won every hand in order, including 64,523, the death's head of free cell, in just under 4 years. That was 88 games a day, every day, including Christmas, New Year's, and the 4th of July. So assuming the kid took a day off every now and again to do kid things, or even just come down with a good case of the flu, the real number was probably more like 100. Richards didn't see how that was possible. Didn't he ever go to school? Didn't he have homework? When did the little bastard sleep? Richards' office, like all the underground spaces of the compound, was little more than a fluorescent box, everything pumped in and filtered. Even the light felt recycled. It was a little after 2:30 in the morning, but Richards got by on less than 4 hours of sleep a night. He had for years, so he paid this no mind. On the wall above his station, 36 time-stamped monitors displayed every nook of the compound, from the guards freezing their asses off at the front gate, to the vacant mess hall with its empty tables and dozing drink dispensers, to the subject containment areas 2 floors below him with their glowing infectious cargo, and farther down, through another 50 feet of rock, to the nuclear cells that powered it all and would keep the lights on, the juice flowing for 100 years, give or take a decade. He liked having everything where he could see it at a glance, where he could read it, like the cards. Sometime between 5 and 6 a.m., they'd be taking a delivery, and he figured he might as well just stay up all night for that. Subject processing took a couple of hours at the most. He could grab a few winks at his desk afterward if he had to. Then, on the computer screen, he saw the answer. It was right there, under the 6. The Black Queen he needed to move the jack and free up the 2 and so on. A couple of clicks, and it was over. The cards shot up the screen like a pianist's fingers flying over the keys. "Do you want to play again?" You're goddamn right he would. Because the game was the world's natural state. Because the game was war. It always was. And when wasn't there a war on somewhere to keep a man like Richards in good employ? The last 20 years had been kind to him, a long run at the table with nothing but good news from the cards. Sarajevo, Albania, Chechnya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Pakistan, Sierra Leone, Chad, the Philippines and Indonesia and Nicaragua and Peru. Richards remembered the day, that glorious and terrible day, watching the planes slam into the towers, the image repeated in endless loops. The fireballs, the bodies falling, the liquefaction of 1 billion tons of steel and concrete, the pillowing clouds of dust. The money shot of the new millennium, the ultimate reality show broadcast 24/7. Richards had been in Jakarta when it happened. He couldn't even remember why. He'd thought it right then. No, he'd felt it, right down to his bones. A pure, unflinching rightness. You had to give the military something to do, of course, or they'd all just fucking shoot each other. But from that day forward, the old way of doing things was over. The war, the real war, the one that had been going on for 1,000 years and would go on for 1,000,000 more. The war between us and them, between the haves and the have-nots, between my gods and your gods, whoever you are, would be fought by men like Richards. Men with faces you didn't notice and couldn't remember, dressed as busboys or cab drivers or mailmen, with silencers tucked up their sleeves. It would be fought by young mothers pushing 10 pounds of C4 in baby strollers and schoolgirls boarding subways with vials of sarin hidden in their Hello Kitty backpacks. It would be fought out of the beds of pickup trucks and blandly anonymous hotel rooms near airports and mountain caves near nothing at all. It would be waged on train platforms and cruise ships, in malls and movie theaters and mosques, in country and in city, in darkness and by day. It would be fought in the name of Allah or Kurdish nationalism or Jews for Jesus or the New York Yankees. The subjects hadn't changed. They never would. All coming down after you'd boiled away the bullshit to somebody's quarterly earnings report and who got to sit where. But now, the war was everywhere, metastasizing like a million maniac cells run amok across the planet, and everyone was in it. Which was why Noah had made a certain sense back when it all started. Richards had been with the project since the beginning, since his first communique from Cole. Rest in peace, you little shit. He'd known it was something important when Cole actually came to see him in Ankara 5 years ago. Richards was waiting at a table by a window when Cole strolled in, swinging a briefcase that probably had nothing in it but a cell phone and a diplomatic passport. He was also wearing a Hawaiian shirt under his khaki suit, a nice touch, like something out of Graham Greene. Richards almost laughed. They ordered a pot of coffee and Cole got started, his smooth face animated with excitement. Cole was from a little town in Georgia, but all those years at Andover and Princeton had tightened up the muscles in his jaw, making him sound like Bobby Kennedy channeling Robert E. Lee. The boy had nice-looking teeth, too. Ivy League teeth, straight as a fence and so white you could read by them in a dark room. "So," Cole began, "think of the A-bomb. How it changed everything just to have it. Until the Russians set off their own in 49, the world was ours to do as we liked. For 4 years it was Pax Americana, baby. Now, of course, everybody and his uncle was cooking one up in his basement, and at least 100 rust-bucket Soviet-era warheads were floating around on the open market, and those were just the ones we knew about. And, of course, Pakistan and India had burst the cherry with all their bullshit. Thanks a bunch, fellas. You made incinerating 100,000 people over diddly squat just another day at the office of the Deputy Undersecretary of the War on Terror." "But this," Cole said, and sipped his coffee. "Nobody else could do this. This was the new Manhattan Project. This was bigger than that." Cole couldn't go into details, not yet. "But for the sake of context, think of the human form itself, weaponized. Think of the American way as something truly long-term, as in permanent." Which was why Cole had come to see him. He needed somebody like Richards, he explained. Someone off the books, but not only that. Someone practical, with practical skills. People skills, you might say. Maybe not right away, but in the coming months, as the pieces gathered to form the whole. Security was paramount. Security was at the absolute top of Cole's list. That's why he had come all this way and put on this ridiculous luau shirt. To get the buy-in. To get this piece of the puzzle nailed down. All well and good if things had gone according to plan, which they hadn't, not by a long shot, starting with the fact that Cole was dead. A lot of people were dead, in fact, and some, well, it was hard to say just what they were. Only three people had come out of that jungle alive, not counting Fanning, who was already well on his way to being, well, what? More than Cole had bargained for, that was for sure. There might have been more survivors, but the order from Special Weapons was clear. Anybody who didn't make it to the dust-off was bacon with a side of toast. The missile that screamed in over the mountains had made sure of that. Richards wondered what Cole would have said if he'd known he wouldn't be one of them. By then, by the time Fanning was safely locked away, Lear was on site in Colorado, and everything that had happened in South America had been wiped from the system, Richards had learned what it was all about. VSA, for very slow aging. Richards had to hand it to whoever had dreamed up that one. VSA. Very silly abbreviation. A virus, or rather a family of viruses hidden away in the world, in birds or monkeys or sitting on a dirty toilet seat somewhere. A virus that could, with the proper refinements, restore the thymus gland to its full and proper function. Richards had read Lear's early papers, the ones that had gotten Cole's attention, the first one in Science and the second in Journal of Paleovirology, hypothesizing the existence of an agent that could significantly lengthen human lifespan and increase physical robustness, and has done so at select moments throughout human history. Richards didn't need a PhD in microbiology to know that it was risky stuff. Vampire stuff, though no one at Special Weapons ever used the word. If it hadn't been written by a scientist of Lear's stature, a Harvard microbiologist, no less, it all would have sounded like something from the Weekly World News. But still, something about it hit a nerve. As a kid, Richards had read his share of such stories, not just the comic books, Tales from the Crypt and Dark Shadows and all the rest, but the original Bram Stoker, and seen the movies, too. A bunch of silliness and bad sex, he knew that even then. And yet wasn't there something about them that struck a deep chord of recognition, even of memory? The teeth, the blood hunger, the immortal union with darkness. What if these things weren't fantasy, but recollection, or even instinct, a feeling etched over eons into human DNA of some dark power that lay within the human animal, a power that could be reactivated? Refined. Brought under control. That was what Lear had believed. And Cole, too. A belief that had taken them into the Bolivian jungle, looking for a bunch of dead tourists. A bunch of, as it had turned out, undead tourists. Richards disliked the word, but couldn't think of a better one, undeadness being, in the end, a pretty solid descriptor of the condition. Who had killed, ripped apart, really, what was left of the research team, all except for Lear, Fanning, one of the soldiers, and a young graduate student named Fortas. If not for Fanning, the whole thing would have been a total loss. Lear. He had to feel for the guy. Probably he still thought he was trying to save the world. But he'd sold that dream up the river the minute he'd gotten into bed with Cole and Special Weapons. And truth be told, it was hard to say what Lear was thinking these days. The guy never came off L4, slept down there in his lab on a sweaty little cot and took his meals off a hot plate. He probably hadn't seen the sun in a year. Back at the start, Richards had done a little extra digging and come up with a number of interesting tidbits. Exhibit A being Lear's wife's obituary in the Boston Globe, dated just 6 months before Cole had come to see him in Ankara, a full year before the Bolivia fiasco. Elizabeth Maycomb Lear, age 41, B.A. Smith, M.A. Berkeley, Ph.D. Chicago, professor of English at Boston College, associate editor of Renaissance Quarterly, author of Shakespeare's Monsters, Bestial Transformation and the Early Modern Moment, Cambridge University Press, 2009. A long battle with lymphoma, etc. There was a picture, too. Richards wouldn't have said Elizabeth Lear was a knockout, but she'd been pretty enough in a slightly undernourished way. A serious woman with serious ideas. At least there weren't any kids involved. Probably the chemo and radiation had ruled this out. So, really, when it came down to it, how much of Project Noah was really just one grieving man sitting in a basement, trying to undo his wife's death? Now, 5 years later, and who knew how many hundreds of millions down the rat hole, all they had to show for their troubles were about 300 dead monkeys, who knew how many dogs and pigs, half a dozen dead homeless guys, and 11 former death row inmates who glowed in the dark and scared the shit out of absolutely everybody. Like the monkeys, the first human subjects had all died within hours, blazing with fever, bleeding out like busted hydrants. But then the first of the inmates, Babcock, had survived. Giles Babcock, as bullshit crazy a man as ever walked the earth. Everyone on L4 called him the talker, on account of the fact that the guy couldn't shut up even for a second, not before and not after. Followed by Morrison and Chavez and Baffis and the rest, each refinement making the virus progressively weaker so the inmates' bodies could combat it. 11 vampires. Why not use the word? Who weren't much good to anyone as far as Richards could tell. Sykes had confessed that he wasn't sure you could actually kill them, short of shooting an RPG down their throats. VSA. Vampires say, ah. The virus had turned their skin into a kind of protein-based exoskeleton, so hard it made Kevlar look like pancake batter. Only over the breastbone, a strike zone about 3 inches square, was this material thin enough to penetrate. But even that was just a theory. And the sticks were just crawling with virus. 6 months ago, a technician had been exposed. Nobody could quite figure out how. But one minute he was fine, the next he was puking onto his faceplate and seizing on the floor of the decon chamber, and if Richards hadn't seen him twitching on the monitor and sealed the level, who knew what might have happened? As it was, all he'd had to do was purge the chamber and watch the man die, then call for cleanup. He thought the tech's name was Samuels, or Samuelson? It didn't matter. The scrubbers showed up clear of virus, and after a 72-hour quarantine, Richards had unsealed the level. He didn't wonder for a second that he'd pull the plug if and when the time came. The Elizabeth Protocol. Richards had to hand it to whoever had come up with the name, if it was somebody's idea of a joke. Though, of course, there was no doubt in Richards' mind who that somebody was. The name was pure coal. Vintage coal, you might say, since coal was coal no more. Beneath that smarmy country club exterior had always lain the heart of a true Machiavellian cut-up. Elizabeth, for Christ's sakes. Only coal would have actually named it for the guy's dead wife. Richards could feel it now. The whole thing was adrift. Part of the problem was the sheer boredom of it all. You couldn't drop 80 men onto a mountainside with nothing to do but count rabbit skins and ask them to stay put and keep their mouths shut forever. And then there were the dreams. Richards had them too, or thought he did. He never quite remembered. but he sometimes woke up feeling like something strange had happened in the night, as if he'd taken an unplanned trip and only just returned. That's what had happened with the two sweeps who'd gone AWOL. The castrati had been Richards's idea, and for a time it had worked out nicely. You'd never meet a more docile bunch of fellows. Mellow as the Buddha, every one, and when the game was finally over, nobody that anyone was ever going to miss. The two sweeps, Jack and Sam, had gotten out of the compound by stuffing themselves into a couple of garbage bins. When Richards tracked them down the next morning, holed up in a red roof by the interstate 20 miles away, just waiting to be caught, that's all they could talk about. The dreams. The orange light. The teeth. The voices calling their names from the wind. They were just fucking berserk with it. For a while he just sat on the edge of the bed and let them talk it out. Two middle-aged sex offenders with skin soft as cashmere and testicles the size of raisins, blowing their noses on their hands, blubbering like kids. It was touching in a way, but you could listen to something like that for only so long. "Time to go, boys," Richards said. "It's all right. Nobody's mad at you." And he drove to a place he knew, a pretty spot with a view of a river, to show them the world they'd be leaving, and shot them in the forehead. Now Lear wanted a kid. A girl. Even Richards had to pause and think about that. A bunch of homeless drunks and death row inmates were one thing, human recyclables as far as Richards was concerned. But a kid? Sykes had explained that it had to do with the thymus gland. The younger it was, he'd told Richards, the better it could fight off the virus, to bring it to a kind of stasis. That was what Lear had been working toward. All the benefits without the unpleasant side effects. Unpleasant side effects. Richards had to allow himself a laugh at that. Never mind that in their former human lives, the glow sticks had been men like Babcock, who'd cut their mother's throats for bus fare. So maybe that had something to do with it, too. Lear wanted a clean slate, somebody whose brain hadn't filled up with junk yet. For all Richards knew, he'd come asking for a baby next. And Richards had gotten the goods. A few weeks of trolling until he'd found the right one. Caucasian Jane Doe, approximately age 6, dumped like a bad habit at a convent in Memphis by a mother who was probably too strung out to care. 0 footprint, Sykes had told him, and this girl, this Jane Doe, approximately age 6, wouldn't have parted a summer breeze. By Monday, though, she would be in the care of social services, and you could just kiss her 6-year-old backside goodbye. That left a 48-hour window for the grab, assuming the mother didn't return to claim her like a piece of lost luggage. As for the nuns, well, Walgast would find a way to handle them. The guy could sell sun lamps in a cancer ward. He'd proved that well enough. Richards turned from his screen to eyeball the monitors. All the children were snug in their beds. Babcock looked like he was jabbering away as usual, his throat bobbing like a toad's. Richards flicked on the audio and listened for a minute to the clicks and grunts, wondering, as he always did, if it added up to something. "Let me out of here," or "I could go for some more rabbits right about now," or "Richards, the first thing I'm doing when I get out of here is coming for you, brother." Richards himself spoke a dozen languages. The usual European ones, but also Turkish, Farsi, Arabic, Russian, Tagalog, Hindi, even a little Swahili. And sometimes, listening to Babcock on the monitor, he got the distinct feeling that there were words in there somewhere, chopped up and scrambled, if only he could teach his ears to hear them. But listening now, all he heard was noise. "Couldn't sleep?" Richards turned to find Sykes standing in the doorway, holding a cup of coffee. He was wearing his uniform, but his tie was undone and the flaps of his jacket hung open. He brushed his hand through his thinning hair and spun a chair around to straddle it, facing Richards.
Right, Sykes said. Me neither.
Richards thought to ask him about his dreams, but decided against it. The question was moot. He could read the answer in Sykes's face.
I don't sleep, Richards said.
Not much, anyway.
Yeah, well.
Sykes shrugged.
Of course you don't.
When Richards didn't say anything, he tipped his head toward the monitors.
Everything quiet downstairs?
Richards nodded.
Anyone else going out for a walk in the moonlight?
He meant Jack and Sam, the sweeps. It wasn't Sykes's style to be sarcastic, but he had a right to be steamed. Garbage bins, for Christ's sakes. The sentries were supposed to inspect everything coming in or out, but they were just kids, really. Ordinary enlisted. They acted like they were still in high school, because that's pretty much all they knew. You had to keep riding them, and Richards had let things slide.
I've spoken to the OD. It's not a conversation he's going to forget. You wouldn't by any chance want to tell me what happened to those guys.
Richards had nothing to say about that. Sykes needed him, but there was no way he'd ever bring himself to like him, or for that matter, approve of him. Sykes stood and stepped past Richards to the monitors. He adjusted the gain and zoomed in on the one showing zero.
They used to be friends, you know, he said. Lear and Fanning.
Richards nodded.
So I've heard.
Yeah.
Well.
Sykes took in a deep breath, his eyes still locked on zero.
Hell of a way to treat your friends.
Sykes turned to point his eyes at Richards, still sitting at his terminal. Sykes looked like he hadn't shaved in a couple of days, and his eyes, squinting in the fluorescent light, were cloudy. He appeared, for a moment, like a man who had forgotten where he was.
What about us? He asked Richards.
Are we friends?
Now that was a new one on Richards.
Sykes's dreams had to be worse than he'd thought.
Friends? Who cared?
Sure, Richards said, and allowed himself a smile.
We're friends.
Sykes regarded him for another moment.
On second thought, he said, maybe that's not such a hot idea.
He waved the idea away.
Thanks anyway.
Richards knew what was bothering Sykes. The girl. Sykes had a couple kids of his own. Two grown boys, both West Point, like the old man, one at the Pentagon doing something with intelligence, another with a desert tank unit stationed in Saud. And Richards thought maybe there were grandkids somewhere in the mix, too. Sykes had probably mentioned this in passing, but it wasn't the sort of thing they usually talked about. Either way, this thing with the girl wasn't going to sit well with him. Truthfully, Richards didn't really give a damn what Lear wanted, one way or the other.
You really should get some shut-eye, Richards said. We've got intake in...
He checked his watch. 3 hours.
Might as well just stay up.
Sykes moved to the door where he turned and gave his weary gaze to Richards again.
Just between us. And if you don't mind my asking, how'd you get him here so fast?
It wasn't hard. Richards shrugged. I got him on a troop transport out of Waco. Bunch of reservists, but it counts as a federal corridor. They landed in Denver a little after midnight.
Sykes furrowed his brow. Federal corridor or not, it's too quick. Any idea what the rush is all about?
Richards couldn't say for sure. The order had come from the liaison at Special Weapons. But if he had to guess, he would have bet it had something to do with the sweaty cot and soup-encrusted hot plate and a year without sunshine or fresh air, with the bad dreams and the red roof and all the rest of it.
Hell, if you looked at the situation carefully, something he'd long since stopped bothering to do, it probably all went back to the bookishly pretty Elizabeth Macomb Lear, long battle with cancer, etc., etc. I called in a favor and had the purge done from Langley. System-wide, soup to nuts. From a big-box perspective, Carter is already nobody. He couldn't buy a pack of gum. Sykes frowned. Nobody's nobody. There's always someone who's interested. Maybe so. But this guy comes close. Sykes lingered another moment at the doorway, saying nothing, both of them knowing what the silence was about. Well, he concluded, I still don't like it. We have a protocol for a reason. 3 prisons, 30 days. Then we bring him in. Is that an order? A joke. Sykes couldn't give him an order, not really. That he could was a pretense Richards only indulged. No. Forget it, Sykes said, and yawned into the back of his hand. What would we do? Return him? He rapped the side of the door with his hand. Call me when the van gets here. I'll be upstairs. Not sleeping. Funny thing. When Sykes was gone, Richards found himself wishing he'd hung around. Maybe they were friends, in a sense. Richards had been on bad jobs before. He knew there was a moment when the tone changed, like a quart of milk left out on the counter too long. You found yourself talking as if nothing mattered, like the whole thing was already over. That was when you got to actually liking people, which was a problem. Things fell apart fast after that. Carter was nobody unusual, just another con with nothing but his life to trade away. But the girl. What could Lear want with a 6-year-old girl? Richards returned his attention to the monitors and picked up the earphones. Babcock was back in the corner, chattering away. It was funny. Something about Babcock always gnawed at him. It was as if Richards was his, like Babcock owned a piece of him. He couldn't shake the feeling. Richards could sit and listen to the guy for hours. Sometimes he'd fall asleep at the monitors. Still wearing the headphones. He checked his watch again, knowing that he shouldn't but unable to stop himself. It was just past 3. He wasn't in the mood for another hand of cards, never mind that little bastard in Seattle, and the hours of waiting for the van to pull into the compound suddenly opened before him like a mouth that could swallow him whole. There was no fighting it. He adjusted the volume and settled back to listen, wondering what the sounds he heard were trying to tell him. Chapter 6 Lacey awoke to the sound of rain fanning into the leaves outside her window. Amy. Where was Amy? She rose quickly, threw on a robe, and hurried down the stairs. But by the time she reached the bottom, her panic had eased. Surely the child had simply gotten out of bed in search of breakfast, or to watch TV, or simply to have a look around. In the kitchen, Lacey found the girl sitting at the table, still in her pajamas, forking bites of toaster waffle into her mouth. Sister Claire was sitting at the head of the broad table, dressed in sweats from her morning jog through Overton Park, holding a steaming mug of coffee and reading The Commercial Appeal. Sister Claire wasn't actually a sister yet, just a novitiate. The shoulders of her sweatshirt were dappled with rain. Her face was moist and flushed. She put the paper down and smiled at Lacey. Good, you're up. We've already had our breakfast, right, Amy? The little girl nodded, chewing. Before she'd joined the order, Sister Claire had sold houses in Seattle, and as Lacey took a place at the table, she saw what the sister had been reading. The real estate section. If Sister Arnett had seen this, she would have been annoyed, might even have given one of her impromptu speeches about the distractions of material life. But the clock on the stove said it was a little after 8. The other sisters would be next door at Mass. Lacey felt a stab of embarrassment. How could she have slept so late? I went to early services, Claire said, as if answering her thoughts. Sister Claire often went to the 6 a.m. before her daily jog, which she referred to as a visit to Our Lady of Endorphins. Unlike the rest of the sisters, who had never been anything else, Claire had lived a whole life outside the order. Been married, made money, owned things, like a condo and nice shoes and a Honda Accord. She hadn't felt the call until she was in her late 30s and divorced from the man she once referred to as the worst husband in the world. Nobody knew the details, except perhaps Sister Arnett, but Claire's life was a source of wonder to Lacey. How was it possible for a person to have two lives, so very different from each other? Sometimes Claire would say something like, "Those are cute shoes," or "The only real good hotel in Seattle is the Vintage Park," and for a moment all the sisters would be stunned into a silence that was one part disapproval, one part envy. It was Claire who had gone to shop for Amy, the unstated implication being that she was the only one of them who really knew how to do this. "If you hurry, you can still make it to the 8 o'clock," Claire offered. Though, of course, it was too late. Claire's real meaning, Lacey understood, was something else. "I can watch Amy." Lacey looked at the girl. Her hair was disordered from sleep, but her skin and eyes were bright, rested. Lacey ran the tips of her fingers through the girl's bangs. "That's very kind of you," Lacey said. "Perhaps today, just this once, because Amy is here." "Say no more," Sister Claire said, and laughing, halted Lacey's words with a hand. "I'll cover for you." The looming day assembled in Lacey's mind. Sitting at the table, she remembered her plan for the zoo. When did it open? What about the rain? It would be best, she thought, to be out of the house before the other sisters returned. Not only because they would wonder why she hadn't come to Mass, they might also start to ask questions about Amy. The lie had worked so far, but Lacey felt its softness, like a floor of rotten boards beneath her feet. When Amy had finished her waffles and a tall glass of milk, Lacey led her back upstairs and got her quickly into her clothes. A fresh pair of jeans, stiff with newness, and a t-shirt with the word "Sassy" stenciled on it, the letters outlined with sequins. Only Sister Claire would have possessed the courage to choose something like that. Sister Arnett wouldn't like the shirt, not at all. If she saw it, she'd probably sigh and shake her head, as she always did, souring the air of the room. But Lacey knew the shirt was perfect, just the sort of thing a little girl would want to wear. The sequins made the shirt special, and surely that's what God would want for a child like Amy. Some happiness, however small. In the bathroom, she wiped the syrup off Amy's cheeks and brushed out her hair, and when this was done, she dressed herself in her usual pleated gray skirt and white shirt and veil. Outside, the rain had stopped. A warm, unhurried sun was gathering in the yard outside. The day would be hot, Lacey guessed. A blast of warmth sailing in from the south behind the cold front that had pushed rain over the house all night. She had a little cash, enough for tickets and a treat, and the zoo, of course, was something they could walk to. They stepped outside, into air that had begun to swell with heat and the sweetness of wet grass. The bells of the church had begun to bong out the hour. Mass would be ending at any moment. She led Amy quickly through the garden gate, through the tart aroma of herbs, the rosemary and tarragon and basil that Sister Louise tended so carefully, into the park where people were already gathering for the first warm day of spring, to taste the sun and feel it on their skin. Young people with dogs and frisbees, joggers plodding along the paths, families staking out shady tables and barbecue pits. The zoo stood at the north end of the park, flanked by a broad avenue that cleaved the neighborhood like a blade. On the far side, the big houses and wide, princely lawns of old Midtown were forgotten, replaced by shotgun shacks with broken-down porches and half-assembled cars melting into the packed dirt yards. Young men floated up and down the streets like pigeons, roosting on this corner or that, and then moving on, all of it benumbed with idleness and vaguely ominous. Lacey should have felt better about this neighborhood than she did, but the blacks who lived there were different from Lacey, who had never been poor, at least not in the same way. In Sierra Leone, her father had worked for the ministry. Her mother kept a car and driver for shopping trips to Freetown and the polo matches at the fairgrounds. One time they'd attended a party where the president himself had danced a waltz with her. At the edge of the zoo, the air changed, smelling of peanuts and animals. A line had already formed at the entrance. Lacey purchased their tickets, counting out her change to the penny, then took Amy's hand again and led her through the turnstile. The little girl was wearing her backpack with Peter Rabbit inside. When Lacey had suggested that it could remain at the house, she had seen quickly in the flash of the girl's eyes that this wasn't even a question. The bag was nothing she could leave. "What do you want to see?" she asked. 20 feet from the entrance, they found a kiosk with a large map, blocked out in colors for different habitats and species. A white couple was examining it, the man with a camera swinging from a lanyard around his neck, the woman gently pushing a stroller back and forth. The baby, buried in a mound of pink fabric, was asleep. The woman glanced at Lacey and regarded her momentarily with suspicion. What was a black nun doing with a little white girl? But then she smiled, a little too forcibly, a smile of apology, of retraction, and the couple moved away down the path. Amy peered at the map. Lacey didn't know if she could read, but there were pictures beside the words. "I don't know," she said. "Bears? What kind?" The girl thought a moment, scanning the images. "Polar bears." Her eyes warmed with anticipation as she spoke. The idea of the zoo, of seeing the animals, was something the two of them now shared. It was just as Lacey had hoped. As they'd stood there, more people had come through the gate. Suddenly the zoo was humming with visitors. "Also, zebras and elephants and monkeys." "Wonderful," Lacey said and smiled. "We will see them all." At a snack stand, they bought a bag of peanuts and made their way into the zoo's interior, its rich zone of sounds and smells. As they approached the polar bear tank, they heard laughter and splashing and shouts of hilarious terror, a mixture of voices both young and old. Amy, who had been holding Lacey's hand, released it suddenly and dashed ahead. Lacey made her way between the shoulders of the people who had gathered at the bear tank. She found Amy standing with her face just inches from the glass that gave an underwater view of the bear's habitat. A curious sight in the Memphis heat, with rocks painted to look like ice floes and a deep pool of Arctic blueness. 3 bears were basking in the sun, lounging like gigantic rugs by a fire. A 4th was paddling in the water. While Amy and Lacey watched, he swam right up to them and, fully submerged, bumped his nose on the glass. The people around her gasped. A jolt of pleasurable fear shot down Lacey's spine into her feet and fingertips. Amy reached out and touched the sweating glass inches from the bear's face. The bear opened his mouth, showing his pink tongue. "Careful there," a man behind them warned. "They may look cute, but to them you're just lunch, little girl." Startled, Lacey turned her head, searching for the source of the voice. Who was this man, to try to scare a child like that? But none of the faces behind her returned her look. Everyone was smiling and watching the bears. "Amy," she said softly, and put her hand on the girl's shoulder. "Perhaps it's best not to tease them." Amy seemed not to hear her. She leaned her face closer to the glass. "What's your name?" she asked the bear. "There now, Amy," Lacey said. "Not so close." Amy stroked the glass. "He has a bear name. It's something I can't pronounce." Lacey hesitated. Was it a game? "The bear has a name." The girl looked up, squinting. A knowing light was in her face. "Of course he does." He told you this. The pool erupted with a tremendous splash. The crowd drew a sharp intake of breath. A second bear had leapt into the water. She paddled through the blue toward Amy. So now there were two, bumping the glass just inches from her face, their bodies big as automobiles, their white fur rippling in the underwater currents.
"Will you look at that?" someone said.
It was the woman Lacey had seen at the kiosk. She was standing beside them, holding her infant up to the glass by the armpits like a doll. The woman, whose long hair was stretched away from her face by a tight ponytail, was wearing shorts and a t-shirt and flip-flops. Lacey could discern through the folds of her shirt the still loose belly of her pregnancy. The husband was behind them, guarding the empty stroller and holding the camera.
"I think they like you," the woman said to Amy.
"Look, sweetie," she sang and jiggled the infant, making her arms flap like a bird's.
"See the bears? See the bears, sweetie? Honey, take the picture."
"Take the picture." "I can't," said the man. "You're not looking the right way. Turn her around." The woman sighed irritably.
"Come on, just take it while she's smiling. Is that so hard?"
Lacey was watching this when it happened. A second splash, and then, before she could turn her head, a third. She felt the glass bulge beside her. A ridge of water crested the lip and began to fall, everyone aware of what was happening, but powerless to act.
"Look out!"
The icy water hit Lacey like a slap, filling her nose and mouth and eyes with the taste of salt, hurling her back from the glass. A chorus of screams erupted all around. She heard the baby's cry, and then the mother yelling, "Get away! Get away!" Bodies banged against her. Lacey realized she'd closed her eyes against the stinging salt. She tumbled backward, her feet catching and tripping, and fell onto a pile of people. She waited for the sound of the glass breaking, the slam of the tank's unleashed water.
"Amy!"
She opened her eyes to find a man looking at her, his face inches from her own. It was the man with the camera. Around her, the crowd had fallen silent. The glass had held after all.
"Sorry," the man said. "Are you all right, sister? I must have tripped."
"God damn it!" The woman was standing over them, her clothing and hair soaked through. The baby was screaming against her shoulder. Her face was furious.
"What did your kid do?"
Lacey realized she was talking to her.
"I'm sorry," she began. "I don't..."
"Look at her!" The crowds had backed away from the tank, all eyes locked on the little girl with the backpack who was kneeling before it, her hands on the glass, and the four bare faces crowded against it. Lacey climbed to her feet and moved quickly. The little girl's head was bowed, water still raining from her drenched hair onto her knees. Lacey saw that her lips were moving, as if in prayer.
"Amy, what is it?"
"That girl's talking to the bears," a voice cried, and a buzz of wonder went up from the crowd.
"Look at that!"
Cameras began to click. Lacey crouched beside Amy. With her fingers, she pulled the dark strands of the girl's hair away from her face. Her cheeks were streaked with tears, mixed in with all the water from the tank.
"Tell me, child."
"They know," Amy said, her hands still pressed to the glass.
"What do the bears know?"
The girl raised her face. Lacey was stunned. Never had she seen such sadness in a child's expression, such knowing grief. And yet, as she searched Amy's eyes, she saw no fear. Whatever Amy had learned, she had accepted it.
"What I am," she said.
Sister Arnett, sitting in the kitchen of the convent of the Sisters of Mercy, had decided to do something. It was 9 o'clock. It was 9:30. It was 10 o'clock. Lacey and the girl Amy had not returned from wherever they had gone. Eventually, Sister Claire had surrendered the story, that Lacey had skipped Mass and that the two of them had left shortly thereafter, the girl with her backpack.
Claire had heard them leave and then watched from the window as they made their way through the back gate to the park. Lacey was up to something. Arnett should have known. The story about the girl didn't wash. She'd known that right away. Or if not known exactly, then certainly she had felt it, a kernel of suspicion that had grown overnight into the certainty that something was not right. Like Miss Clavell in the Madeline books, Sister Arnett knew. And now, just like in the story, one of the little girls was gone. None of the other sisters knew the truth about Lacey. Even Arnett hadn't learned the full story until the office of the Superior General had forwarded the psychiatric report. Arnett remembered hearing something about it on the news all those years ago, but wasn't something like that always happening somewhere, especially in Africa? Those awful little countries where life seemed to mean nothing, where his will was the strangest and most unknowable of all? It was heartbreaking, horrifying, but the mind could take in only so much, so many stories of this kind, and Arnett had forgotten all about it. And now here was Lacey, under her care, no one else knowing the truth. Lacey, who, she had to admit, was in nearly every way a model sister, if a little self-contained, perhaps a little too mystical in her devotions. Lacey said, and no doubt believed, too, that her father and mother and sisters were still in Sierra Leone, going to palace balls and riding their polo ponies. Since the day she'd been found hiding in a field by the UN peacekeepers who had turned her over to the sisters, Lacey had never said otherwise. It was a mercy, of course. It was God's own mercy, protecting Lacey from the memory of what had happened. Because after the soldiers had killed her family, they hadn't simply gone away. They'd stayed with Lacey in the field for hours and hours. And the little girl they'd left for dead might just as well have been dead, if God hadn't protected her by washing her mind of these events. That he had chosen not to take her at that instant was simply an expression of his will, and nothing for Arnett to question. It was a burden, this knowledge, and the worry that came with it, for Arnett to bear in silence. But now there was the girl. This Amy. Polite to a fault, quiet as a ghost, but wasn't there something rather obviously wrong with the whole situation? Something completely unbelievable. Now that she thought about it, Lacey's explanation made less than no sense. She was friends with her mother? Impossible. Except for daily mass, Lacey barely set foot outside the house. How she would have come into contact with such a woman, let alone a woman who would trust her with her daughter, Arnett could not explain. Because there was no explanation. The story was a lie. And now the two of them were gone. Sitting in the kitchen at 10:30, Sister Arnett knew what she had to do. But what would she say? Where would she start? With Amy? None of the other sisters seemed to know anything. The girl had arrived when Lacey was alone in the house, as she often was. Arnett had tried many times to coax her out, for their days at the pantry and also on small trips, to the store and what have you, but always Lacey declined, her face at such instances radiating a kind of cheerful blankness that put the question instantly to rest. "No, thank you, sister. Perhaps another day." 3, 4 years of this, and now the girl had appeared out of nowhere, Lacey claiming to know her. So if she called the police, the story would have to start there, she understood, with Lacey and the story of the field. Arnett picked up the phone. "Sister?" She turned. "Sister Claire?" Claire, who had just come into the kitchen, still in her sweatsuit, when she should have changed for the day by now. Claire, who had sold real estate, who'd been not only married but also divorced, who still kept a pair of high-heeled shoes and a black cocktail dress hanging in her closet.
But that was an altogether different problem, not the one she was thinking about now.
"Sister," Claire said, her voice concerned, "there's a car in the driveway."
Arnett hung up the phone.
"Who is it?"
Claire hesitated.
"They look like police."
Arnett reached the front door just as the bell was ringing. She drew back the curtain of the side window to look. Two men, one maybe in his 20s, the other older but still somebody she thought of as a young man, the pair of them looking like funeral directors in dark suits and ties. Police, but not exactly. Something serious, official. They were standing in the sunshine at the bottom of the steps, away from the door. The older one saw her and smiled in a friendly way, but didn't say anything. He was nice-looking, but unremarkable, with a trim physique and a pleasant, well-shaped face. A bit of gray fanned away at the temples, which shimmered faintly with perspiration in the sun.
"Should we open it?" Claire asked, standing behind her.
Sister Louise had heard the bell and come downstairs as well. Arnett took a deep breath to calm herself. "Of course, sisters." She opened the door but left the screen closed and latched. The two men stepped forward. "May I help you, gentlemen?" The older one reached into his breast pocket and produced a small billfold. He opened it, and in a flash she saw the initials, FBI.
"Ma'am, I'm Special Agent Walgast. This is Special Agent Doyle."
Just like that, the billfold was gone, returned to the insides of his suit coat. She saw a scrape on his chin. He had cut himself shaving.
"Sorry to disturb you like this on a Saturday morning."
"It's about Amy," Arnett said. She couldn't explain it. She'd just blurted it out like he'd somehow made her do this. When he didn't reply, she continued, "It is, isn't it? It's about Amy." The older agent, his name had already slipped her mind, glanced past Arnett at Sister Louise, sending her a quick, reassuring smile before returning his eyes to Arnett.
"Yes, ma'am. That's correct. It's about Amy. Would it be all right if we came in
to ask you and the other ladies a couple of questions?" Which was how they came to be standing in the living room of the Convent of the Sisters of Mercy. Two large men in dark suits, smelling of masculine sweat. Their hulking presence seemed to change the room, make it smaller. Except for the occasional repairman or a visit from Father Fagan from the rectory, no other men ever came into the house.
"I'm sorry, officers," Arnett said. "Could you tell me your names again?"
"Of course." That smile again. Confident. Ingratiating. So far the young one hadn't said a single word.
"I'm Agent Walgast. This is Agent Doyle."
He glanced around.
"So, is Amy here?"
Sister Claire cut in.
"Why do you want her?"
"I'm afraid I can't tell you ladies everything. But you should know, for your own safety, that Amy is a federal witness. We are here to place her under protection."
"Federal protection?"
Arnett's chest tightened with panic. It was worse than she had thought.
Federal protection? Like something on TV, on those police shows she didn't want to watch but sometimes did, because the other sisters wanted to.
"What did Lacey do?"
The agent's eyebrows lifted with interest.
"Lacey?"
He was trying to pretend that he knew, to open a space for her to talk so he could draw information out of her. Arnett could see this clearly. But of course that's just what she'd done. She'd given them Lacey's name. No one had said anything about Lacey except Arnett. Behind her she could feel the other sister's silence pressing upon her.
"Sister Lacey," she explained.
"She told us Amy's mother was a friend."
"I see."
He glanced at the other agent. "Well, perhaps we'd better talk to her as well."
Are we in any danger? Sister Louise said.
Sister Arnett turned to her with a silencing scowl.
Sister, I know you mean well, but let me handle this, please.
I wouldn't say danger, not exactly, the agent explained. But I think it would be best if we could speak to her. Is she in the house now?
No.
This was Sister Claire. She was standing defiantly, her arms crossed over her chest.
They left, at least an hour ago.
Do you know where they went?
For a moment, no one said anything. Then, within the house, the telephone rang.
Please excuse me, gentlemen, Arnett said. She retreated to the kitchen. Her heart was pounding. She was grateful for the interruption, as it could give her a chance to think. But when she answered the phone, the voice on the other end was no one she recognized.
Is this the convent? I know I've seen you ladies over there. You'll have to pardon my calling like this.
Who is this?
Sorry.
He was speaking in a rush, his voice distracted. The name's Joe Murphy. I'm head of security at the Memphis Zoo.
There was some kind of commotion in the background. For a moment, he spoke to someone else.
Just open the gate, he said. Just do it now.
Then he was back on the line.
Do you know anything about a nun who might be over here with a little girl?
A black lady, dressed like you all do.
A buzzing weightlessness, like a swarm of bees, filled Sister Arnett. On a perfectly pleasant morning, something had happened. Something terrible. The door to the kitchen swung open. The agent stepped into the room, trailed by Sister Claire and Sister Louise. Everyone was staring at her.
Yes. Yes, I know her.
Arnett was trying to keep her voice low, but knew this was pointless.
What is it? What's going on?
For a moment, the line was muffled. The man at the zoo had placed his hand over the receiver. When he lifted his hand, she heard yelling and crying children, and behind it, something else. The sound of animals. Monkeys and lions and elephants and birds screeching and roaring. It took Arnett a moment to realize that she wasn't just hearing these sounds over the phone. They were coming through the open window, too, traveling clear across the park into the kitchen.
"What's going on?" she pleaded.
"You better get over here, sister," the man said. "This is the goddamnedest thing I've ever seen."
Lacey, breathless and running, soaked to the bone. She was carrying Amy now, clutching the little girl to her chest, the girl's legs clamped tightly around her waist, the two of them lost in the zoo, its maze of pathways. Amy was crying, sobbing into Lacey's blouse.
"What I am, what I am!"
And other people were running too. It had